So let me take a minute to introduce our next speaker. Our speaker this morning, Clark Rochefell, and he's ACB's director of governmental, director of advocacy and governmental affairs. Beginning in 2017, he served as program manager of public policy at National Industries for the Blind. In his role there, he was responsible for researching and promoting legislative and regulatory policies to support NIB's mission. He cultivated relationships and collaborated with policymakers and he worked with cross disabilities as well, promoting setting policy priorities. He mentored more than 50 employees as manager of NIB's Advocates for Leadership program. Clark is a competitive cyclist. He competed in the 2012 Paralympics. He holds bachelor's degree from Towson University in political science and economics, and he currently lives in Alexandria, Virginia with his wife, Greta. So Clark, thank you very much for being here, and we look forward to hearing your report. Take it away, please.
Well, thank you, Rob, and thank you to the California Council of the Blind, CCB, for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you all here today. And a big shout out to everyone listening on ACB Radio live stream. Thank you all for tuning in. As Rob said, my name is Clark Rochefell, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs for ACB. I work out of the National Office in Alexandria, Virginia. And Rob gave a quick overview of my background, especially my time with National Industries for the Blind. But more importantly, I've been with ACB now for over 2 years. And in this role, I lead ACB's advocacy as well as public policy efforts. And those public policy efforts on the national level include working with Congress on legislation, working with regulatory agencies on the rules and requirements that they're putting in place, as well as coordinating with the cross-disability community, the other blindness organizations out there, and when possible, and as much as possible, working with and assisting the advocacy efforts of our state and special interest affiliates, such as the California Council. And again, just a big thank you for letting me speak with you all today, but also thank you for your leadership and your leadership in advocacy. Just a quick rundown of the names that I'm seeing who are panelists here, and I haven't even gotten to the attendees yet, but I know Jeff Tom is a very active member of the California Council. And I'm fortunate and privileged to be able to work with and learn from Jeff as he works with the National Office as the chair of the Advocacy Steering Committee, as well as the Advocacy Services Committee, and also in his role with the AAVL, Alliance of Aging and Vision Loss. And I'll probably call on this guy a little bit later. I see Gabe Griffith. Not only is he in leadership of CCB, but he's also one of our co-chairs of the ACB Resolutions Committee, a very important committee that helps us ensure that the voices of our members and affiliates are being heard in the advocacy work that we are doing. And then also, flying a little bit under the radar, I see Guillermo Robles, and website accessibility is an issue that is bubbling up more and more. So I know that the CCB members and folks listening are very active in advocacy efforts. focusing on those areas of specific interest and importance to you. So thank you all for the work that you are doing and the initiative that you're taking to drive advocacy efforts forward. With the National Office and in my role as Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs, I love my job because I have the ability to really impact the ACB mission of striving to increase the security, independence, economic opportunity, and quality of life for people who are blind and experiencing vision loss. Some of the ways that we are doing that here in 2021, as many of you know, we are in the first term of the 117th Congress for the federal government, the House of Representatives, and the U.S. Senate. Our legislative imperatives this year, quick overview here, and of course, thank you to all of you for participating in the DC Leadership Conference, the legislative seminar, in meeting with your elected officials on Capitol Hill. One of our imperatives is the Disability Access to Transportation Act, H.R. 1697. The bill has been reintroduced in the House. The original sponsors of this legislation are Representatives Langevin from Rhode Island, Representatives Titus from Nevada. And due to your advocacy efforts and your meetings on Capitol Hill, there is a new co-sponsor, Representative Napolitano from California. So again, thank you all for your initiative and following through on that legislative imperative. This bill would increase access to paratransit. It would provide funding for pilot programs. These pilot programs would create more flexibility in how paratransit services are offered, as well as requiring the federal government, the U.S. Access Board, to complete the rulemaking on the public right-of-way accessibility guidelines, PROAG, and provide additional funding for Section 5310 grants, which are used by transit services in rural, low-income, minority communities to increase service offerings. So our ultimate goal here is to get as many co-sponsors as we can. Currently, the co-sponsors in the House are all Democrats. This bill was bipartisan last year. There's no reason it shouldn't be bipartisan here in 2021 as well. And we would like this to be included in the reauthorization of the Surface Transportation Bill, the FAST Act, which needs to be reauthorized to provide funding for roads, bridges, transportation infrastructure. Again, this needs to be reauthorized by the end of September of this year. Most likely, this reauthorization will be included in the very, very large infrastructure package that Congress and the administration have currently put out their opening bids, their opening salvos. The White House is seeking, I don't want to get my numbers confused. Once you add a trillion to numbers, it gets a bit muddied in my mind, but it's either around $2 or $2.9 trillion. And Republicans in Congress had this week laid out their vision, which was around $500 or $600 billion. So plenty of room to negotiate, and we'll see what happens. As part of those negotiations, we really want the DATA Act, Disability Access to Transportation Act, H.R. 1697 to be included. Our other two legislative imperatives have not yet been reintroduced. This is the Medicare Demonstration of Coverage for Low Vision Devices Act, as well as the Exercise and Fitness for All Act. So the Low Vision Devices Bill would create a pilot program and allow doctors to, much like they provide a prescription for other durable medical equipment, provide a prescription for low vision devices, devices that exceed $500, so big ticket items, so that Medicare can cover them and make it easier for folks to get their hands on these devices and not have them be required to pay out of pocket and front the very large upfront costs to receive these low vision devices that will aid them in living independently and integrated in their community. And the Exercise and Fitness for All Act is just like it sounds. It would require government guidelines and regulations for the creation as well as the purchasing and making available accessible exercise and fitness equipment. I know a lot of us can get by memorizing buttons or by labeling, brailing, putting bump dots on exercise and fitness equipment. And we can get it to a point, so the cardio equipment, where we can start a workout and we can get by, right? But just like all other users, we deserve equal access to all of the features as well as feedback from the machines on the work that we're doing. People with disabilities have much higher rates of obesity, chronic health conditions, heart disease, and of course, diabetes. Diabetes being the leading cause of blindness for working-aged adults, disproportionately impacting people of color as well. One of the many ways that we can work to try to address this is by making exercise and fitness equipment more accessible so that it is more usable by people with disabilities so that we can take charge of our own health and fitness and get up and get moving, especially as we're all coming out of COVID and the pandemic here, so we hope going forward. So that's a quick overview of our three legislative imperatives. That's not all the National Office is working on, and a few other items that have been front of mind and effort. First, I can't talk about our advocacy work without talking about I don't like to use the I word, but really the inspiring work of our members and affiliates over the past few years on expanding access to voting. Not only in-person voting, ensuring that what is mandated by HAVA, the Help America Vote Act of 2002, is being implemented, but also pushing the envelope. And see that, Gabe, that's a pun there, because vote by mail and voting with a paper ballot and returning that ballot via the mail has just proliferated so widely the past few election cycles. However, voting with a paper ballot is inherently inaccessible. This is not new information for all of you on ACB radio live stream or in the CCB here attending. We know that paper ballots are accessible. We know this is why we have accessible ballot marking devices in the polling place. So why, when we are outside of the polling place, are we expected to be able to complete with a pen, a paper ballot, and apply a wet signature and return that by mail? So many states, including California, have allowed for accessible means to request, receive, and complete our absentee ballots. In many states, like California, then you're still required to print this ballot and mail it in for return so that it can be properly counted and cast. But there is another way. And several states like Maine, Massachusetts, Delaware, North Carolina, West Virginia, parts of Utah and Hawaii and Washington and Oregon are allowing voters with disabilities to do all the steps that California is doing as well. Accessibly through your own assistive technology and electronically request your ballot, receive it, complete your ballot. But then those states that I just mentioned and those locations I just mentioned are allowing folks to go one step further, and that is electronically return your ballot. So instead of having to find a printer, make sure your printer is working, has ink, doesn't just run a blank paper through, print out your completed ballot. Now you've got to find the envelope, fold it, sign it, mail it, get it to a Dropbox. We've taken accessibility one step further, and that allows you to just click a button that says submit or download your ballot as a PDF and then attach it to an email, cutting out the need of having to fumble with paper, cutting out the need to properly address sign, or mail an envelope, or get to a drop box. Once these electronic ballots are returned, they are printed, so there is still a paper record to be counted and recounted when it's appropriate to do so. But then it's also cast in that format. And what peace of mind that brings to folks in West Virginia, North Carolina, Delaware, Maine, Massachusetts, and the other states, not only voters with disabilities, but uniformed and overseas citizens have been able to vote this way for decades. In more than half of states that allow for folks to electronically receive, mark, and cast their ballots, return their ballots so that they can be cast. And we're really working to expand this method of voting, but then also on the national level, ensure that federal policies or ensure that federal voting reforms don't prohibit access to this most accessible means of voting for people with disabilities. In addition to voting, it talked about HAVA from 2002. Well, there's another issue that ACB has been working with and dealing with since 2002, and that has to do with accessible paper currency. There's been renewed focus on adopting, amending, changing some federal paper currency to include the portrait of Harriet Tubman. This was first raised in, I think, Obama's second term, so 2012 to 2016. It got sidetracked over the 2016 to 2020 during the Trump administration. And very early on, President Biden and First Lady Harris, Vice President, Madam Vice President Harris, made it a priority again. And at ACB, we agree. Our currency should be inclusive, should represent all of America. And as long as we're talking about a currency redesign, we would like to remind folks that in 2008, a federal court ruled that the next currency redesign must include accessibility for people who are blind. So prior to Biden and Harris putting renewed focus on this issue, the next currency redesign was going to occur in 2026. Now they're talking about a 2024 redesign of the $20 bill to include the portrait of Harriet Tubman. And we are very supportive of that. We are all for a 2024 currency redesign, because that would be the next currency redesign, and accessibility must be included. We've communicated this to the White House, to the U.S. Treasury, to the Federal Reserve. Eric Bridges, our executive director, was quoted in a Wall Street Journal article in the U.K., where they were highlighting their 50-pound note becoming the last bill to receive a tactile feature. And President Dan Spoon had an op-ed published in The Hill, DC Beltway publication, pointing this out as well. So we will continue our advocacy on this issue as much as possible. And whenever possible, we'll partner with the organizations, including groups like Women on 20s, who are championing our cause as well. So certainly more to come on accessible currency. And then the other item that I'd like to bring up, a big item, we touched on it a little bit earlier, website accessibility. There's been a little bit of news on this front. So backing up a couple years to the fall of 2019, the Supreme Court decided not to hear an appeal regarding the Ninth Circuit Court's decision on a case, Domino v. Robles. And that was good news, because who knows what the Supreme Court would have done, right? Well, here in April, just about 2 weeks ago, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Florida, Alabama, and Georgia, offered a split decision. They ruled 2-1 that the ADA does not cover websites. So a bit of a step back, but in the grand scheme of things, we're still trying to figure out what it means. That decision, a judge has anonymously requested from the 11th Circuit that that decision go to an en banc hearing before the entire panel of judges in the 11th Circuit. I'm sure that there will be opportunities for ACB, the Department of Justice, National Council on Disability, and other organizations to file friend of the courts or amicus briefs to say, yes, in fact, the Americans with Disabilities Act does apply to websites. So more on that front. There's also legislation, the Online Accessibility Act, which has been reintroduced in the 117th Congress. This is something to be aware of, but it is online accessibility legislation drafted without input from the disability community and from the perspective of the business community. So what do I mean by that? There are notice and cure provisions where someone with a disability would not be able to file suit or bring a lawsuit against a company for an inaccessible website. You'd have to notify the company, wait for them to fix it, then wait a little longer if they don't fix it before you could take action on your civil rights. Obviously, we don't like that. We do and certainly would like to have rules of the road in terms of website accessibility regulations, but we also believe that companies don't need it to be spelled out to them. You know, this is one of those issues. If there were guidelines, they would say that they're too restrictive. Now that there aren't guidelines, they say they don't know what to do. It's just an instance where they want to have their cake and eat it too. The Department of Justice has been quite clear that websites must be accessible. There have been accessible standards for websites since, geez, I think, either 94 or 95 that Sir Tim Berners-Lee has talked about website accessibility, as well as Professor Greg Vanderheiden, who's now at the Trace Center at the University of Maryland College Park. And of course, we do have the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines that are those international, principles and guidelines for individuals, organizations, companies to follow. And the WCAG guidelines have been incorporated into the Section 508 refresh for the federal government. So going forward, we're interested to see how the new ruling from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, if, how, when that moves the needle, what comes from the en banc review, and whether there is an appetite either in Congress or at the Department of Justice to pass legislation or regulations dealing with website accessibility. Another issue, and then this will be the last thing I raise before we open it up for questions here. There's been some recent developments on autonomous vehicles, and this is very late breaking, and there'll be more information coming early next week, but there is an effort to include an amendment to a bill called the Endless Frontier Act. This legislation seeks to maintain the United States' innovation and technological advantage when dealing with foreign trade, primarily focused on the country of China. And there are, I guess, partners of ACB in the automotive industry who would like to include an amendment on autonomous vehicles. Why does this matter to us? Well, autonomous vehicles and this technology is one of the most promising ways to increase equitable transportation access for people with disabilities, whether that's folks in low-income communities, folks who are not served by public transportation, or folks in rural parts of the United States where public and paratransit is not available. So we are and have been very supportive of moving forward the opportunities to test and innovate with autonomous vehicles. Once again, California, you all are leading the way in this effort, especially in the San Francisco area. And I know our partners like Waymo and Cruise are very thankful for the support that you all have provided over the years. And you'll certainly be some of the first to benefit from this new technology. But as we look at a national framework, we want to ensure that, as these vehicles and technology are tested, that there's not a license requirement for someone with a disability or someone who's blind to benefit from using an autonomous vehicle as a rideshare service or a taxi or a shuttle. We want to make sure that companies are able to innovate with accessibility and have the freedom to do so and aren't restricted by federal regulations in this space. So there are certainly things that we can be supportive of in this amendment. So stay tuned with more information here for next week. Again, thank you for letting me drone on to you all on a Saturday morning. You get to hear my voice as you try to wake up with your cup of coffee or your cup of tea on the West Coast. And I guess I'll turn it over to our Zoom host to see if there are any questions or raised hands of other issues that folks would like to bring to the attention of the national office, or have questions on any other issues that I've touched on so far.
Hello, can I talk now? Sorry.
Well, I was waiting to find out if somebody was going to be managing the questions here, but yeah, Regina, go ahead.
Thank you, Deb. So, Clark, thank you for visiting the West Coast. I am interested in two things. Number one, that when talking about the return of the electronic ballot, have they in those states worked out the security piece? Because that's our biggest barrier, is the security. People said, oh, it's not secure, even though a lot of stuff is done over the internet.
Mm-hmm. Like,
and how do you address that? My second question is about the George Floyd Equity in Policing Act. Is there anything in there that pertains to people with disabilities, given that 30 to 50% of those unarmed who experience use of force incidents are disabled? That's my question.
Sure. Thank you, Regina. And I'll start with the second item, the George Floyd Equity in Policing Act. This is a bill that I am aware of, but I have not looked at closely. I've not seen much chatter from the cross-disability community for the ways that this bill could impact people with disabilities. So that's something that I will need to get back with you on and look into more. Your first question about the security of electronic ballot return. There's a lot of misleading information that's being shared out there about the electronic return of ballots. First, this is not new technology. As I stated, the uniformed and overseas citizens have been able to electronically return their ballots for over a decade now. Depends on the state where they're registered to vote and what those states decide to implement. But states, at least 26 states, allow some voters to electronically return their ballot, whether that's by fax, email, or electronic portal. And some folks will say, well, you can't hack a paper ballot. And let's be honest, we all know that that is... It's a great sound clip, right? But that is a inherently inaccurate and flawed statement. Election security has been a primary focus and objective well before electronic voting, and not just because folks want to have secure elections, but because it's necessary. And we need to have integrity in our elections. The terms, there are multiple terms used. I'm sorry, I'm blanking. It's a Saturday afternoon for me. Dealing with fraudulent elections when all there were paper ballots. There's ballot harvesting, where ballots are collected and completed. There's voting down ballot. If somebody only voted for the governor or the president, you can go in and fill in the votes below for the party of your choice or the candidates of your choice. There's simply throwing away the ballots you don't want to count. These are not hypotheticals. These are things that have happened for decades, not in large enough numbers to influence the outcome of an election, but they are real ways to tamper with voting. So fast forward to electronic return. There is no evidence that electronic votes have been tampered with in U.S. elections. Election security, much like election accessibility, is a journey. You will never have a 100% secure election or a 100% secure anything. And you will never have a 100% accessible election or technology. We all live this on a daily basis. We know that accessibility and usability is a continuum, right? And we want to have the most accessible voting that we can. But just like all other voters, we want our votes to matter and to count. So I think it's a bit of a red herring to say that electronic return is insecure. It is. It's proven to be so. But we're not immune to this fear as well. So what can we do to make electronic voting and electronic ballot more secure? And one of those items would be to include absentee voting in the definition of a voting system within the Help America Vote Act. Because the Election Assistance Commission, through HAVA, has the responsibility to test and certify voting systems. All of the accessible ballot marking devices and the companies that produce them have had to go through this testing and certification system by the Election Assistance Commission. So wouldn't it make sense to have accessible remote absentee voting be subject to the same testing and certification process? I think this is a reasonable way that we can increase the trust in these absentee voting systems while still spurring forward technology and innovation so that we can democratize voting as much as possible, not only for people with disabilities, but get it to everyone who finds it difficult to get to the polls or complete a ballot at the polls or to complete their paper ballot that they receive in the mail.
Well, thank you, Clark. I think we've got time for one more question, Alice. Hopefully with a short answer. It's Alice, go ahead.
Oh, sure. Actually, I'll make this very quick, Clark. Alice Turner here from Government Affairs and Vista Center. Thanks for your report. Just very quickly, we ended up having a really fabulous work when it came to our legislative process for the virtual experience, and just wondering if at some point we would hear some information about how other states did when it came to reaching out virtually. There were some challenges and there were some great experiences. Know that folks in ACB are very busy, but at some point that information would be really helpful. So thanks.
Alice, may I ask you to rephrase that so I have a better sense of what you're looking for?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So for our our visits, for the legislative visits, we did those virtually, as everyone did, in meeting with Congress and Senate. And one of the challenges had to do with scheduling. And we were wondering if those challenges were experienced across the states. Does that help?
That does. And
okay. Thanks, Clark.
Absolutely. Thanks, Alice. President Spoon, when speaking with the affiliate presidents, as well as the advocacy steering committee, we heard some of that from our affiliates. And of course, we're talking about the leadership conference and the Capitol Hill meetings. And there wasn't a single clear answer in that regard. So some states found, and even within states with some members, found it very easy to get in touch and schedule meetings. Others, some offices were not very responsive. But I think the beauty of the virtual meeting is that we were able to engage more members from our affiliates statewide to participate, to dip their toes in the advocacy water and experience these meetings. It also provided the opportunity, especially using video, to share some of the low vision devices or what is inaccessible about exercise and fitness equipment. Because we didn't have to lug a treadmill or a CCTV or, you know, a video magnifier through the halls of Capitol Hill. So there were certain advantages, but yes, we did hear that some folks had trouble scheduling, but then I'll finish with a final advantage. We also didn't have to cram all our meetings into one day. So I know that some folks, even a week and 2 weeks after the leadership meetings and the day on Capitol Hill, we're still working to schedule those meetings. If you do have members that you are still having difficulty scheduling with, please reach out to advocacy@acb.org, and we'd be happy to work with you to see if we can find a more direct or responsive contact within that member's office. But thanks for that question, Allison.
And Clark, thank you for a very thorough and informative report. I certainly enjoyed it and really glad you could be here, and we sure appreciate it.
Absolutely. And as we say at the end of the Advocacy Update podcast, which you can find on ACB Radio, keep advocating, California.
Keep advocating indeed. Okay, is our esteemed treasurer available to draw a door prize? Okay, I'm not hearing anything.
I am. I'm.
Oh,
here.
There she is. There
I'm
she is.
I'm so sorry. Let's get it queued up here.
She's gonna spin that wheel.
So let's do a $25 Amazon gift card, donated by the Fresno chapter. And the winner is Connie Bateman.
Hey, Connie. All right, way to go. All right, next week we're going to hear a message from a wonderful service called California Phones. And I have to admit, I've benefited from them many years ago with one of their big button phones. So let's go ahead and hear the message from California Phones.
Hi, my name is Michelle with California Phones, and we're proud to partner with the California Council of the Blind Virtual Convention for the year 2021. If you'd like to learn more information about California Phones, please feel free to visit our website at californiaphones.org.
Okay, thank you, Debbie. Thank you, California Phones.